Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And as you might not be surprised to know, we're going to spend a good bit of this show talking about a lot of what we saw over the weekend coming out of Boston, the mass anti-racist protest. And we're also going to be speaking with the former special assistant of Dick Gregory and some remembrance of him after he has passed. But before we can move on. The Trump administration and advisory committees really seem to not be getting along too well. In the wake of the president's coddling of white supremacists after the terrorist attack in Charlottesville by racist terrorists, both of the president's major economic policy bodies folded. CEOs decided, well, he was just too racist for them to continue without consequences to their own and their businesses. Reputations. President Trump has just announced that he is taking the action to get rid of another presidential advisory committee. This time it's the Federal Climate Advisory Committee that Trump is tanking. And I guess not that surprisingly, given what he's done on climate change so far. Trump has stacked his cabinet with climate deniers and himself called climate change a Chinese hoax. The committee's entire purpose is to check out the various elements of climate science and try to develop new policies and help improve existing ones to conform to the latest research on the rapidly changing climate. Principally, the committee was tasked with developing the National Climate Assessment, which is a major piece of research that, as its name implies, presents an overall view of what's going on with climate change. Then, a 15-person committee of scientists, corporate executives, and varying specialists parsed the thing for new policy and best practices. This is a key part of the Trump-led war on the planet that is being sponsored by the fossil fuel industry. Eliminating future NCAs and also making it more difficult for the government to quickly and succinctly look at solutions to climate change will help roll back progress towards actually dealing with climate change. And the last National Climate Assessment in 2014 highlighted rising temperatures, crumbling infrastructure, and other important trends. Without this one document coming out, it would be one less fairly authoritative statement in terms of solidifying climate science, which is key because climate deniers know that the science is so overwhelming that climate change is real that they don't really attack it head on. They try to muddy the waters and suggest that climate science is contested, which it is not. Not at all. Since many of these people believe in the quote-unquote full faith and credit of the U.S. government, as it were, government studies proving climate change are particularly problematic because they come from a source that has built-in legitimacy with even climate deniers and thus is harder to refute and certainly more embarrassing to go against. They know they can more easily cast doubt on various independent studies. They can set up their own think tanks to produce rival studies saying climate change is fake or not that bad or whatever. With the government playing a role in the debate, with the government no longer playing a role in the debate akin to a referee, obviously it will become more of a he said, she said type of situation. So Trump disbanding this council is clearly a dagger aimed right at the heart of the attempt to actually do something to maintain the conditions on Earth that make human life possible. Colin Kaepernick is still not on any NFL team, and it's clear that he's being blackballed for daring to speak out against the oppression of black Americans by refusing to stand for the national anthem. Any number of worse QBs have been signed. The Ravens even signed a guy from the Arena Football League. And while league officials keep saying that he is not being banned, the obvious is clear here. And that's been enraging to people who feel like what Kaepernick did was right, or at the very least, he has the right to say what he wants. It also demonstrates something many people have pointed out about the league for years, that it treats its black players extremely paternalistically. And that anger has started to spill over in many different ways. Last week, a group of 50 New York City police officers held a press conference to support Kaepernick. 40 of the officers were active duty and several acknowledged they had been pressured not to appear. They stood in support of Kaepernick's right to speak out and to express the fact that there are problems with policing in America. The momentum from this will continue this week with a protest on Wednesday at NFL headquarters. Further, several players have decided to continue the stand, ironic way to refer to it, I guess, started by Kaepernick to show that the movement cannot be silenced. Black Seattle Seahawks player Michael Bennett, who is also very outspoken on social justice issues, sat for the anthem during a preseason game. His white teammate Justin Britt did not sit but stood next to Bennett with his hand on his shoulder as a show of support. White Eagles player Chris Long put his arm around fellow Eagle Malcolm Jenkins while Jenkins stood with his fist in the air during the anthem. Britt said about why he stood with Bennett, quote, "I want to support what he stands for and his beliefs." NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell could be facing added pressure, and that the Georgia State NAACP has announced a boycott of the NFL until Kaepernick is signed to a team. Clearly, this is not going away, and even if Kaepernick is signed, it's likely players will continue to protest during the anthem because the problems continue to be ongoing. One of the most popular memes of the 2016 election was the fictional tale of the Bernie Bro. That is the suggestion by Clinton supporters that all Sanders supporters were young white men, bros, who were boorish, racist, and sexist, and whose political views are self-centered as opposed to being progressive. This was always a complete canard, particularly because Sanders was consistently getting majorities of younger women at the polls and in the voting booths. And when it came to people of color, black millennials, just to give you one example, in one poll not long before the election, were still 30 percentage points less likely than their parents and grandparents to say that they had favored Hillary over Sanders. Just to further ram home how foolish this was, a recent poll for NBC, also done in conjunction with Marist, examined politicians' favorability ratings in swing states and had some interesting numbers as well. In Pennsylvania, 77% of black voters have a favorable opinion of Bernie Sanders, as opposed to 48% of whites. 75% of Democrats overall in that state have a favorable sense of Sanders. In Michigan, 85% of black voters have a favorable view of Sanders as opposed to 53% of white. Ironically enough, even 33% of those in Michigan, so that's one-third, who identify as conservative or very conservative also support Sanders. So again, it's worth noting that the most popular politician in America, someone who calls themselves a socialist, supports the movement for black lives, at least rhetorically, and wants free health care for everyone in the United States. Seems like the whole Bernie bro thing should probably be retired at this point. And that is it for today's Talking Points. And you were listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are continuing our conversation here, turning a bit to the legacy of the late Dick Gregory, who died over this weekend at 84 years old. Legendary black comedian, legendary civil rights figure, legendary social justice figure on so many different levels. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Keith Silver, who was the special assistant to Dick Gregory, also headed up the Southern Christian Leadership Conference here in Washington, D.C., as well as being an advisory neighborhood commissioner here in the District of Columbia. Keith, thank you so much for being willing to join us here.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much, Brother Eugene. I really appreciate the thought and the kindness of you and your staff and Bob for considering me. I'm glad to be on the air today with you guys.
No, of course, of course. And so obviously this is for many people such a tragic weekend to see Mr. Gregory pass. But I did think in some ways, Keith, that it was poignant that the same weekend that Dick Gregory passed, there was this massive demonstration in Boston against racism, against bigotry, that really caught the eye of the world. And that in some ways, I think it spoke to sort of the spirit of who Dick Gregory was. You were able to know the man personally. Talk a little bit about your relationship with him, if you could.
Well, Eugene, thank you. It's all true. Our friend, our brother, the honorable, the esteemed, and most importantly, the unbought Mr. Dick Gregory has transitioned. You know, Eugene, if I had to capture the essence of Dick Gregory in 10 words or less, I guess it would be Dick Gregory daily walk with God and God daily walk with him. And that just about says it all on my end. I guess the single most little known important fact about Dick Gregory is long before it became fashionable, long before celebrities or high-profile folk with alternative reasons decide to adopt causes to enhance their status, Dick Gregory not only daily put his life on the line, but time and time again put his anticipated income on the line. With his wonderful wife and 10 children by his side from the mid-50s to this present moment, and you know for a fact, because I had the opportunity to meet your loving mother, Eugene, before, it's not easy to make that type of commitment when you put your income and your 10 children on the line, along with the causes you support. I'll be honest. This showed me one person other of Dick Gregory's stature, other than Dr. Martin Luther King, from the late 50s to this present moment, that daily put their life and future anticipated salary on the line, and you have the third person on that list with Dr. King and Dick Gregory.
Mm.
But you're right. Vincent Boston spoke on the essence of Dick Gregory because he continuously daily fought for the downtrodden, the bypassed, and the polarized peoples of the world. So you were exactly right.
I think that's a great point, Keith. And I think one of the things that those of us who live in the District of Columbia certainly know that I was telling people this weekend that I think is one of, you know, the most telling things about Dick Gregory is, you know, he so often showed up to events, political events, social justice events here in the D.C. area, but not as a star. It would be like you're standing there and you look to your left and the next thing you know, Dick Gregory is in the crowd. And that sort of mentality that he seemed to have on that, even though he was world famous, that he was just kind of another guy in the movement. I mean, I think every event I ever saw him at in D.C. that I was involved in organizing, he never even asked to speak. You know, we had to ask him. And I thought that incredible humbleness of how he participated in movements as well was really unique.
Well, I tell you, Brother Eugene, you captured the essence of Dick Gregory before, I mean, even better than I'm trying to do, because you could see him in the crowd, the humbleness and the sincerity of this guy, and yet he's the same iconic figure, and everything everybody know about him is true, but if you meet him, he's just, and if you got a chance to know him, he was just like the regular guy you might have grew up in the neighborhood, or you just personally knew. He had that kind of humbleness and understanding of his position in the order of life, that's the way he carried himself. And I'll be honest with you, Eugene, I know your listening audience, everybody probably has their own unique Dick Gregory story, just as you shared, because I'll be honest with you. I mean, if I'm going to just say one thing, because I'm still somewhat in a state of shock, because, you know, just fast, but let me just say this. We all have been blessed to witness a continuous 84-year continuous curtain call for Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory's life and times was just one continuous 84-year curtain call. You just said it. A curtain call, as we know, is the appearance of one or more performers on the stage after the performance to acknowledge the audience applause. Heck, if you didn't catch Dick Gregory before he left, he didn't stick around for applause or standing ovation. He always cited the people that did the groundwork to pull these events off, and he'd just walk on off and thank and praise God, and then he had work to do. So I appreciate what you just said, because you did a wonderful job capturing the essence of the man right there. Wonderful.
And, you know, as someone who, and I think many people have listened to his comedy, I mean, it seems like he also had this, I mean, you know, it was in a way, it was so understated. And especially, you know, when he'd speak at rallies and he would make his jokes, it was so understated, but they were always so cutting, like the kind of thing that really stuck with you, you know, the next day when you really thought about it. And he just seemed to have this unbelievable ability that, you know, I don't know that there's many comedians, political comedians, that have had this to sort of make light of so much of the racism that we face as Black people, but in a way that I think really sort of touched people in a place that it was hard to get away from.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Eugene, that is so true, because quite frankly, all this comedy and all that came from just his creative genius. He didn't have time to script this out. He could speak on current events and be just as poignant, just as articulate, and he didn't mind telling the, you know, putting a slight bit of humor in there to keep to break things up. But that was the man. He could speak to the issue point blank on whatever came up. And quite frankly, he was authority on many, many subjects, quite frankly. I mean, you can talk about anything. UFO. Well, you know that he went to talk to the Ayatollah Khomeini and all the wonderful things. People can Google the history of Dick Gregory. That's the way he was for 84 straight years until his transition. That's so true.
You know, I think it's just so, you know, telling in so many ways, someone who's just 84 years old when he passed, who really sort of consistently never gave up the fight on so many different causes, who kind of pioneered fasting. I'm curious if you were ever, not pioneered, but really turned it into his own personal thing. And a lot of people who have fasted on political causes over the years have you know, used Dick Gregory as a resource. Obviously, his famous fasting lemon drink, I believe. Anyway, I'm curious, Keith, if you were ever around in any of those fasts that Dick Gregory carried out and what that was like as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can tell you about my first fast when I joined him in 1982. But more importantly, let me tell you with a couple of his other fasts that everyone should know about, or if they don't, they need to Google this. Dick Gregory was called upon by all the major forces or high-profile people you could think of even before we were born. If your listening audience will Google the Beatles, the guy that wrote Imagine All the People in the World Today, he credited Dick Gregory for joining him when him and Yoko Ono was fasting in England. He called on Dick Gregory to come and instruct him while they was on the fast. And he ended up coming out of the past writing the song Imagine, and it's in his book. He credits Dick Gregory for being the inspiration. Now, to talk to you about Dick Gregory's humor, him and Yoko Ono was in the bed doing this fast, and they said, well, you can get in the bed with us. He said, no, I don't play that stuff. That's to show you his quick wit on what to do. But he would put that, and that's a true story. And then at Dick Gregory's top weight, I think he was 350 pounds when he was in the late 50s. He was the highest paid black entertainer in the late 50s. But then he got more socially conscious. And after he started getting more health conscious, he went on his fast. He dropped from his top weight to 350 pounds. And then when he passed this past week, I think he was down to maybe 110, 112 pounds. But we all know him in his current weight size. So I just be honest, that's how his mind was so keen and sharp, because when people got to understand it, and we all have the power to do that, if you sincerely pray and sincerely fast, God will send you answers out the clear blue sky, even beyond your expectations. And Dick Gregory had a way of tapping into that power when he was in a crisis situation. Well, it was just a way of life for him. So he became an authority on cooking with his books, Cooking with Mother Nature, and all those other books. And quite frankly, I would be remiss in my brother's and your brother's absence, not to mention on September 4th, his last work, he just finished the final editing to his book, which will be released on September 4th, entitled Reading Between the Lies, L-I-E-S, by Dick Gregory. And doctor, if you ever want to see a work of art, That supersedes all his books, Eugene, and that's what we want.
Well, I'll tell you what, Keith, we're gonna be looking for that for sure. I appreciate you be willing to join us. That is Keith Silver, who we were talking to, the former special assistant of Dick Gregory, former head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference here in the District of Columbia, as well as an advisory neighborhood commissioner. We are going to take a break. On that note, we're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the massive rally. I guess you could call it anti-fascist, anti-racist, just I thought all around fantastic event there in Boston yesterday, counting the so-called quote-unquote free speech rally. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Bomani Arma, a writer, poet, music producer, MC, and art integration specialist, and Rachel C. Long, who is an organizer with the People's Congress of Resistance, who is there on the ground in Boston this weekend and also helped organize some of those events. Thank you both so much for being here on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Eugene.
And so, Rachel, I'll start with you. I mean, my assumption is that most people who are listening to this have heard at least a little something about what took place on Saturday. But just to sort of set the scene, big, massive event. Give us some sense what took place there, what the events were like on Saturday on the marches and on the Boston Green.
Wonderful. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people definitely have heard about it, but I think there's something about being there where you could really feel the energy. It was an incredible, incredible display of solidarity and just power. I mean, we organized an event, you know, with a speak out, about 4,000 people, 5,000 people on Facebook said they're coming. And to our surprise, you know, the Commons actually filled up with about 40,000 people because of all the different events that kind of were going on converged into one place. So, you know, 40,000 people all in the Commons when there was only about, you know, 20 of these, you know, right wing, 20 of these alt-right fascists who came out. So it was really an incredible display of the power of the people when we come together, and everyone was chanting, everyone was loud, everyone was so live and so full. you know, spirit and solidarity with one another. So it was definitely a beautiful thing to see.
You know, Bomani, I don't know if you, like I, was at least catching snippets of it. I was trying to watch a bit of it, what I could find in the course of my day. I mean, you know, it just seems to me that, I don't know, for me, and I'm from Charlottesville, Virginia, so it's a slightly different piece. You know, it has a very cathartic effect to see how many people were galvanized by this event, that the events that took place there, to feel compelled to come out. I mean, I wonder what you see in what took place and seeing such a massive, I guess, counter-protest, but it almost seems like, you know, that was the real protest, not the counter-protest.
Right. I mean, from Charlottesville all the way to Boston, I was, especially with Boston, I was heartened to see so many people out there. I mean, like, the ratio was ridiculous. Wasn't it like 2,000 to 1?
Yeah.
Alt-right versus people protesting. So here's the thing. Like, it was a powerful moment. I don't want to give it too much credit, only because the reason 40,000 people came out is being against that group should be a basic American thing. Mm. And since that has been in limbo, you know what I'm saying, for about a week and a half, a whole bunch of Americans said, just in case you didn't know, just in case the guy in charge can't specifically be like, even if you're violent against Nazis, you're the good guy. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like a really basic concept. Then we need to come out and make sure it's said, because everybody under the president, everybody around the president, it was actually amazing to watch that equivocation. And so I definitely want to give people credit, because it needed to have been said, and 40,000 people came out and said it with a lot of gusto, and we needed that to happen. Mm. But it was like, that's like, aren't they the very basic of who we have outcasted? You
right.
know what I'm saying? So I would love to channel that energy towards other things that are going on in racism and inequality in our system. But this is a very good place to start.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that Bomani makes an interesting point there too, Rachel, because I do think that that is one of the most interesting things to me about the way this whole thing is played out, is how it isn't just like super basic that opposing Nazis should be something that people should do on a regular basis, and how ingrained racism really is in this society, where we're even really having a debate over like whether or not basically white power terrorist groups should be able to come out and spread their words. I mean, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. It is very basic to say that, of course, Nazis are bad. The Klan is bad. These types of things are a moral threat, actually. They're an immediate threat to our communities, especially communities of color, LGBTQ communities, women, you know, Jewish communities as well. It's a moral, it's like literally an imperative that we fight against this. And so it should be obvious, but it isn't always. I mean, Trump took two days to even acknowledge that, you know, the good folks apparently that were, you know, around in Charlottesville, that there was white supremacists, right? He wouldn't even acknowledge that. He wouldn't acknowledge it. He wouldn't go into it. And so I think it's Trump really represents kind of a bigger conversation in the nation, too, about people who were very sleeping, not interested in acknowledging the reality of white supremacy. This is not new. This is not a new moment. This is not something that we haven't seen before throughout all of American history. And so I think it's, you know, it's a very basic understanding that we should be coming out and fighting tooth and nail against, you know, fascism, because if anyone remembers World War II, we know what fascism was. And if anyone remembers the history of the U.S. and the Klan, we know what that is. We know what that's done throughout history. So it's our duty, actually, you know, as people with any conscience, people in general who have any idea what's right or wrong, to come out and to get organized and to fight fascism at every turn in every way.
And let me ask you this follow-up too, Rachel, because it's now just dawning on me. You are from Lowell, Massachusetts, which is right there in the Boston area. I mean, Boston actually has, unfortunately, quite a history of sort of racist, fascist activity. So were you in some ways also heartened to see that they weren't able to rally a big force of people, kind of in an area where historically they've been strong in terms of these white supremacists?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, for me, I mean, first of all, 40,000 people, it's, you know, if you're from New York, you're from D.C., it's like, all right, 40,000 people. In Boston, that's probably perhaps the biggest demonstration I can even think of within my lifetime. And even speaking with other organizers who are older than myself, I'm only 24. Also, you know, it's one of the biggest things they've seen in Boston. So it's definitely a different climate there, to say the least. 40,000 people is very significant in a place like Boston. And I'm from Lowell. And in Lowell, Massachusetts, you know, where I grew up, I mean, Donald Trump literally visited, you know, the high school where I went to school. There were 5,000 people when Trump came to speak at the Songus Arena who came to support Trump. And, you know, we rallied the community and we got 400 people out to stand against them. But it's overwhelming, the white supremacy that exists in Massachusetts and in Boston, just because it's quote unquote liberal state means absolutely nothing in reality. You know, where I grew up, there are parts of the community you can't go. if you're somebody who's of color, right? You can't go to certain streets, certain neighborhoods, because they're white, and you're not welcome to come there. There are so many white supremacists. I went to school with a kid whose parents were, like, neo-Nazis and, like, flew flags, and that was normal. And I think it's really important to see that. Like, you know, in Boston, to come out, to see people come out like that just really filled my heart with a lot of joy. Because, you know, so many years, my community, you know, we experienced our oppression. We're isolated, alone in some ways. You know, we were a town that has a lot of people going through a lot of problems. We really at the bottom, really difficult for a lot of folks. And, you know, most people are not stepping up and standing up. And, you know, a lot of people feel like they can't do anything. I think that this march in particular, this rally in particular, really awoke everybody around me. I brought my brother. He's 15. He felt amazing. He got on the mic. He chanted because for the first time in his life, he got to say no to white supremacy. That is a normal aspect of his daily life, where we can't go, where we can't drive, whatever it is. You know, it meant so much to him to feel like he could do something. And I think, like, demos like this, like, for places like where I grew up, mean the world. I saw a lot of folks that I knew actually from my community out, so it was very beautiful to see.
You know, Bomani, one of the voices that I heard speak sort of or saw some take at this event, it was a pre-recorded message, Derek Washington. He's incarcerated in MCI Norfolk in Massachusetts, where, for folks who don't know, there's actually a deep struggle going on around clean water. The prisoners have very dirty water there. But in his message, he said something about the demonstration, I think everything that's kind of going on about fascism. I wanted to read this quote to you and get your thoughts on it, because I thought it was poignant. He said, the question of representation is always at the forefront of any democratic society. So what is a nation that doesn't represent the entirety of its citizens and its population? And it does seem to me that that's like kind of a subtext here under this whole thing, and under a lot of what is angry, why people are angry about Trump's comments, is like, how can the president, you know, be so, embrace such a divisive ideology? But then I think, I mean, when has this country ever not had presidents and on the same token? But your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I mean, I agree. You have to feel underrepresented if you heard what Trump said. Just on the basic logic of, even if, like, there are only two type of people who support Confederate monuments, racist and ignorant people. Mm. People who don't understand the context in which they were built, the meaning for having generals who led the war to keep slavery mounted above your city square as if they won. Mm. You know what I'm saying? Not even like walking next to their horse. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. With their head down and their flag. You know what I'm saying? Like, man, we messed that up, but, you know, we marched back. You know, no, it's like they're riding their steed as if they marched into town and changed things, right? When literally, like, and someone please challenge me on this, what can possibly historically be more anti-American than a Confederate soldier? Mm. Like, nothing, right? Literally. So the fact that we're having this conversation is really, like, it's still throwing me off.
Yeah.
But what I'm hoping is going to happen is that we take this moment to educate everybody on exactly what's going on. I don't participate in protests. I don't go out and march. And I'm not against them. I did them at one point. As a matter of fact, I think I was blessed in the time period that I was going to marches and I was protesting, I was doing them with organizations that when they saw you protesting, they grabbed you and brought you into other organizations. You know what I'm saying? I was doing like the Blackout Arts Collective, and I was doing other things. I was like at some of these specific things, the prison industrial complex. And so that's what I'm hoping is going to happen. That's what I think is going to answer Derek's problem right there, is that the people, the 40,000 people who show up, we don't just, especially the people who have been a part of the fight the whole time, we don't just let them show up to the event and leave without showing them how they can, even in just a several hours a week or several moments a day, continue to represent. Continue to make sure Donald Trump can't avoid these conversations. For Donald Trump to be able to say, like, so what I was going to say is, if there are two types of people, racist and ignorant people that show up to these kind of rallies, right? If you're one of those people who thought that the Confederate legacy was just something genteel and Southern, and you wanted to show up to protest that, when you showed up and saw Nazi flags, wouldn't that be your cue to be like, oh, nah, this is not my day to come out here and protest this. Right. I'm going to let them march by themselves. You know, and so the entire instance to me, and, you know, you brought me on here as the artist and the educator is the one who gets most agitated about this. I even feel a weird sense of empathy for some of those kids who were caught up in marching on UVA's campus with their torches. Not that I don't want like their lives to be jacked up. It needs to be like, you can't recreate a Ku Klux Klan Nazi meeting and then not have an effect on your life. But these kids who were only introduced to this lifestyle from the internet did not realize the risk they were taking being a part of this march. Like, it was just completely over their heads. And they're completely now branded. And I'm not saying this like I wanted to not brand them.
No, for sure.
But they just...
It's presented to them as a game sort of a virtual world. And then these people bring them into the streets as basically cannon fodder for whatever their, you know, Richard Spencer's Matt Hombachs of the world.
Some of these guys, this was a phase, and now it has to be their life. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't know what they were into. They didn't realize the meaning why they wore hoods.
Mm, right.
There was a reason you wore hoods to do this.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you did it in Nazi Germany when you were the majority or you were able to control the actual government, and they were under the impression that they were controlling the government. And so they've walked into, there's a whole bunch of people who are marching with them who are racist, who I would fight if I saw them and I had to, you know, demand, you know, their freedom or mine, their life or mine. But they didn't realize what they were stepping into.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole system and the Confederate statues being a big emblem of them is doing a horrible job of letting people know what this country is based on and what's been going on and who to advocate for in these situations.
Yeah, you know, and I think about these Confederate statues and I just think of, like, you know, there are no statues of British soldiers that, like, burned down D.C. in the War of 1812.
It doesn't happen.
I mean, it really is, like, the most insane thing. But I think, Rachel, that Bomani does touch on a great point and a very relevant point, and one that I from some of the remarks, at least, I heard that I believe that you made, and at least among others that you were with, also speaking to the point of this, of it not being a one-off, and, like,
right.
that being as dangerous as anything else. And there are so many other, you know, important struggles. And, I mean, maybe what I'm really saying is sort of, like, The ultimate answer to Trump is, like, how do we build the power of the people, right? Like, to me, like, a big answer to, like, how these fascists are coming out is if, you know, if every tenant in a major city like New York is in a tenant union fighting against their landlords for, like, a decent place to live or whatever. Like, building that counter power so people don't feel as hopeless. I don't know. That, to me, also seems super important in terms of how we interpret these events and how we sort of try to direct the people who are showing up at them. But I'm curious your thoughts about them.
Most definitely. I mean, definitely the point that I made at the demonstration, it was real, comes from the heart, and it comes from the honest truth about where this movement needs to go, is that, yes, come out. Yes, it's a moment, right? It's a moment. We're feeling this moment. But it's a movement. And in order for a movement to win, you need power. You need real people's power. You need to build an institution of people's power, not funded by the grass, not funded by the corporation, not funded by, you know, any Democratic Party, but funded by the people, funded by the grassroots, you know, really running for and by the people. So, I mean, that's why I'm an organizer of the People's Congress of Resistance. And September 16th and 17th, we'll be meeting at Howard University, coming together, all the different leaders, all the resistors, organizers from all different places, especially places like where I come from, you know, places that, you know, we've been hit with the blight, like, to be real, like, our communities have been all types of, you know, ripped, torn up. No jobs, no opportunities. Housing is $900 for, like, you know, a one-bedroom apartment where I grew up, and there's literally no jobs and no public transportation. So the Congress is really a coming together of people from everywhere, not only those who are protesting, those who are resisting in this fight against fascism, this fight against Trump, but those who are resisting on the grassroots level. I know I spoke with a young woman who was fighting to get a statue replaced. This was actually before all Charlottesville went down, before all of this. This was 2 months ago, who in, you know, her area of Maryland was working to get a statue of, you know, one of these racist Confederate statues down and replace it with a statue of Malcolm X. And it's just beautiful to see that there's people who are doing that without even seeing that on the news. That's just their inclination, right? It's their leaders. They're people who are revolutionary in their own way all across the country. So the Congress is a coming together of that to build a real people's institution of power, because we need power. We don't just need marches. We don't just need rallies. We need a real body through which we can make actual change, that we can actually be able to say that we are the power and we can replace the powers that be. So really, for me, that's kind of why I organize with the People Congress of Resistance. And I implore everybody to go on congressofresistance.org or just check out what we're doing, because everyone is welcome. Everyone's a part of it, because it's really, it's a movement. It's not a moment.
You know, I talked to a guy once, a professor in Florida, who's trying to get a statue to Union, Black Union soldiers in South Carolina. A great conversation, but just the resistance to putting that up has been massive. Like, he wasn't even proposing to take anything down, just to put this up, and people haven't really wanted to see it, which, you know, I mean, it is what it is, but I think it's certainly relevant. But Bomani, get in there.
There's a petition in a southern Virginian town to take down a Stonewall Jackson statue and replace it with one of Missy Elliott, which is, like, seems so appropriate to me.
Well, absolutely. Is that in Portsmouth, where she's from?
Because
let me tell you, there's nobody in Portsmouth rocking with Stonewall Jackson. I just know. If you don't know anything about it, trust me.
And if it comes to a vote, I'm pretty sure they'll win. I mean, I'm heartened. Like I said, I think I've been using that word a lot today. Because watching the video clips and even listening to our other guests, Rachel, mm-hmm. I'm talking about being able to organize based off of this. And these are usually people who have been fighting these fights for a long time, but you use moments like this. You know what I'm saying? If the light is shining, you know what I'm saying? And people are interested in being involved beyond, you know, the peripheral stuff, beyond changing your profile picture, beyond showing up and marching. You know what I'm saying? There's a whole bunch of work to be done. And I think it's really important that the organizers who have been there for a while figure out how to best communicate what needs to happen, especially in between these marches, in between these demonstration events. Because what happens is, a brother told me one time, actually Professor Griff told me one time, I asked him about
Public Enemy, famous rap group.
Yeah, and I asked him, like, what do you think about, you know, some of the adults that were out there during the Baltimore uprising trying to help the kids, trying to direct traffic, trying to get them to not break up, you know, the buildings. And he said, you can't sharpen your weapon on the battlefield. You have to have these conversations now. You know what I'm saying? While we don't have these flare-up events. And that's where my part comes in the most, the educational part. These kids aren't ambushed by, oh my God, I can't believe there's racism right here under my nose.
Right.
And that needs to be happening a lot more.
No, I think that's, having been in Baltimore after the uprising, I mean, it speaks to the importance of sort of ongoing popular education, ongoing presence in communities. Right. One of the things, like, I'm most excited about that I'm seeing a lot of is, like, the emergence of these community centers. Rachel, I know you work with the Justice Center in El Barrio. I know here locally, the Organizing for Neighborhood Equity, 1DC, is trying to build one. I saw in Atlanta, Project South just built a new, I think they're calling it a Mutual Aid Center, big piece there. There's the Tubman House, I believe it's called, in Baltimore, where they've taken something out. Like, the creation of these centers, where there's a lot of different things going on a lot of different levels, but it's starting to create sort of, like, you know, everything from arts, music, culture, politics, the hanging out, gyms, the whole nine, but just creating that concrete, constant presence. So we're going to take a break on that note. We're going to come back with more with both of our guests on all of these issues here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing our conversation about a lot of the ripple effects coming out of the massive anti-racist demonstration we saw in Boston over the weekend. We continue to be joined by Bomani Arma, who's a writer, poet, music producer, MC, and art integration specialist, and Rachel Seelong, who's an organizer with the People's Congress of Resistance and was there on the ground helping to bring things together in Boston. And Bomani, I wanted to start with you again here because we were talking a little bit about the importance of education, the role you play as an educator. And this is, like, kind of a crucially important question to me, because this is what I always think about in a lot of these cases is, you know, obviously a lot of these kids are learning on the internet. Some of them are learning it from their families. Like, how do you intervene in a way that's effective in the educational space with the white kid that, like, is coming to school and has heard all this unbelievable negative stuff? And, you know, whatever, they're not necessarily fully formed, but I don't know, how do you counteract that? Because, I mean, they always say that the family is the most important thing. Like, I don't know. I'm rambling now, so
right,
please go ahead.
I got you. So I believe that you got to tell the history of a people from the history of the most disadvantaged, sort of the Howard Zinn approach to history. And so as an African-American, I guess that's kind of convenient because we've always been at the bottom. And, you know, I teach my sons and the children that are under me, you know, teaching directly history and those type of things. Cause I also do teaching where I just take my art form to the normal school system and we integrate it together. And I end up talking about George Washington and trying to, you know, be neutral about George Washington. But when I'm teaching the class, right, I teach it from his slaves' perspective. And what I think you need to do is, and this works very well for African-Americans, especially because one of the reasons I think a lot of African-Americans aren't drawn into history is there's no reason to be drawn into history. It's not about you. Your history class should be about what it was like being a slave of George Washington, what it was like to be a part of the rebellions in the early 1800s, what it was like coming out of Reconstruction, what it was like being part of the Great Migration, what it was like being part of the crack epidemic. Like, you can teach all these eras of history from the perspective of the people who were at the bottom of the rung, and you still understand everything that was going on. You'll still cover Reagan. It'll still cover George Washington. It'll all still happen, right? And so that needs to happen. And I'm saying this because I'm telling you what needs to happen, not what will happen. But that's what needs to happen with these kids when they come to school. Like, they come to school and they're still taught this idea that the founding was a righteous founding when it was nothing close to that. And maybe this can be some kind of compromise. Like, I'm not going to make you come into my classroom where I got Marcus Garvey staring at you from over my shoulder. But when we talk about the foundation of the country, we're going to talk about the fact that you can revere the Constitution, you can revere the Declaration of Independence, but we can go word for word about what elements of those were not upheld and how racist it was and what starting point a huge portion of society, not just Black people, women, landless men, you know what I'm saying? Like, right. You can have a real conversation and talk about how not the founders, not these people who were slave owners, they aren't the genius. The genius is they were trying to find a reason to justify sending other men to die over their taxes. You know what I'm saying? And so in doing so, they wrote these beautiful documents that they didn't believe themselves.
Right.
But the beauty of the country is all these groups that weren't included kept pointing to this document and being like, you said all men are created equal. You said we all have a right to vote. You know what I'm saying? You talk about liberty, and it's been the minorities, quote unquote, calling it out. And so until young men and women are taught the history from that perspective, that it wasn't a perfect country put together and we're trying to go back to a golden age. One of my favorite Dick Gregory quotes, this is the only thing I heard him say at the Million Man March because I arrived late.
how are you about to be the Black man who admits he arrived late to the Million Man March?
It was an extra Black day. I decided to be extra Black. In African cultures, it starts when it starts anyway. At least that'll be my excuse for right now. So I walk up and this is what he says. He's like, stop. He's like, we got to stop telling the young people that it was better back in the day. There is no better back in the day to go to. What are you going back to? Civil rights? What are you going back to? Jim Crow? You going back to slavery? Like right now, and it's still true. He said this in 1993 or whenever that happened. It's still true. Right now is the freest we've ever been. And this is the most opportunities we've ever had. Now, the key is to make sure you understand we're still in a fight, but don't try to glorify.
That could be the most telling aspect, is that this might be the most free we ever had. Do you see how unfree we still are?
Yes.
Like, if there's anything that makes a statement about the oppression of Black people in America.
Right. But we didn't get to this free by people not fighting. Dick Gregory's death, and God bless his family, it comes at a time when he was a supreme athlete of his day. And it comes at a time where people will brag about not speaking out because it's bad for their brand. And Dick Gregory was like, I run straight at it.
Didn't
you know
care
what I'm saying?
At all.
If I'm a track star, like he literally did this. If I'm a track star and you make it illegal for Black people to integrate and run in the track races and win the state championship, I get the NAACP and I attack it. That's exactly what he did. You know, I'm against the war. I will take the inconvenience it does for my career the same way it did for Muhammad Ali, the same way it did for Martin Luther King, by speaking out against the war. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to use your positions of power, and we need to be teaching those stories as much as possible, because these people out here talking this stuff about, I need to worry about my brand so I can't take a stand for these issues, need to be told that they are where they are because of people like Dick Gregory, because of people like Muhammad Ali, and we're not telling their stories correctly.
No, I think that's a good point, and obviously, you know, rest in power, Dick Gregory. I also want to give a quick shout out to his enormously talented daughter, Ayanna Gregory.
Yes.
I have to say, the best live performance I've ever seen. She performed at my friend Jocelyn's birthday party. Unbelievable. I won't get too deep into it, but
she's always on point.
She shamed some people with a couple cover songs too, including the Rolling Stones, that, like, you know, they wouldn't want that album to get out. But, you know, Rachel, I think this is an interesting point. I know that you've worked in after school programs, you work with a lot of student organizers. And I think what Bomani says, certainly for myself, has a lot of truth, that when you start to learn these stories of kind of that alternate history, that people's history, it gives you sort of like a new sense of agency as a young person, where everything a young people is around giving them no agency, right? And sort of having them march to the tune of whatever it is, the school, the society, or whatever it may be, that it creates sort of a new piece. And I'm curious, in your own life and the work that you've done, how much you found that to be true as well.
Almost definitely. I mean, you know, I work with middle school students, and I teach an arts program. It's an arts and social justice program. You know, really just trying to work with students to give them an opportunity to not only just use art, you know, as a way to, like, self-empower, but to learn your history, to know your history. Because when you don't know your history, it's really, really hard to feel a sense of pride, to feel a sense of power, to feel a sense of belonging. I know growing up myself, like, I went to school and we learned nothing about, you know, we learned about the Philippines. We learned anything about the Philippines. We learned that, you know, the U.S. state, the Philippines, and that's just not true. I mean, literally, the Philippines was free, won our freedom from the Spanish, and we were recolonized in the American War, as it's called, in the Philippines, you know, where the Americans recolonized the Philippines. and pretty much took away all of our language, all of our history, all of our culture, everything, and continue to occupy our country today and continue to drop bombs. And I think that kind of knowledge, when you know your history, when you know where your people walk, it's a totally different experience for students. I see them transform overnight. Now, I taught the story of Pancho Villa, the real story of Pancho Villa and other Mexican revolutionaries to some of my students, who many of them are from Mexico. And, you know, their eyes light up. They're middle school and their eyes light up. And it just opens their mind, like, I can be a hero because my people are heroes, walking a legacy of heroes. And it really is an incredible experience for them. And then they say, you know, I hate Donald Trump. Like, my kids were, like, crying, right, when Donald Trump was president. Like, they were all types of messed up. Like, their faces, you could see it. They were scared. They were nervous. And so we did a whole lesson, right, on the history of revolution. We've done a whole history of what people have done and how we fought and how we're going to fight again. And we learned about 2006 when, you know, immigrants came out in mass, went on strike, shut it down. Kids just like them. In, like, 2006, high school students were the ones who led all of the massive walkouts all throughout L.A. and California to demand an end to, I think it's a Sedgwick-Brenner bill. That's basically a lot of Trump's policies, but back in the day, it would make it illegal if you even helped an undocumented person, like they stayed over your house or something. So pretty much like the way that it worked, right, is students shut that down. And so when students know their history, they know they have value, they know how they have a place. I mean, they stand up and they turn out. Like, I work with high schoolers now who come out, like they walked out when Trump became president. Hold the power. Young people are the ones who lead this movement, and so many of them are struggling to connect with their elders, connect with people who can tell them their history. They want to know. They're hungry. And so, you know, as older people in this movement, as organizers, as activists, you know, our responsibility and our job is to constantly reach out and to build with these young folks and to teach them their history so they know and they feel that power too, and for us to come out together. Because young people, you know, the average age of a Black Panther was like, what, 17? Young people really lead this movement, and they're way more conscious and way more ready to move than people expect them to be.
I think that's very true. I'm glad you brought up that moment of the walkouts in 2006, which more people need to tell this story, but I have to say it's one of the more moving stories of how art and protests come together, because as I know you remember, Rachel, and as many people who are listening to this you know might remember, the movie Walkout about the Chicano walkouts in 1968-69 and the Chicano moratorium came out on HBO coincidentally at almost the exact same time these students started walking out. And it was a great movie, great film. Edward James Olmos, who has his own long history as an activist, as a very progressive person in Hollywood, helped put this thing on to give that history of the Chicano movement. And when these students started walking out in LA, HBO started playing the movie like 20 times a day. I mean, and it was 100% clear that they were doing it to like push this movement. And I talked to some students who were involved in that, and they said they were watching this and becoming inspired by what they had seen the people of their parents' generation do that they didn't know that much about. And here it was, you know, so fantastically in this movie, and they were walking out. I mean, it's such an emotional story of how art, and just in that moment, and how even like in a moment like that, Bomani, how like an HBO could be transformed. I mean, like, whatever, the corporate executives at HBO probably aren't good people, but I think it speaks to the power of that moment that somebody there was like, forget the programming schedule, we're playing Walkout 20 times a day.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I know Michael Moore says that the reason he gets away with releasing the movies that he does is because the corporate powers that be realize that even after people see it, they won't do enough to like change anything about it. I don't know if that's completely true. I think it plays into the other thing that you were just talking about. Like the natural teenage impulse is rebellion. And I think too many educators shy away from it instead of pointing them at what they should be rebellious towards, what they should be fighting. You know what I'm saying? The really good educators can turn anything into a lesson. And you can do civics, you can do history, you can do math, you can do science, and you can be talking about what's going on in your community right now. It's actually something I did with young audiences in Maryland and Baltimore this past summer. And it can be very specific to like politics, or it can be stuff just trying to be green, just trying to clean up your neighborhood and deal with, you know, the abandoned buildings that are in your neighborhoods. But one of the things that we have to make sure that we're doing is that we're integrating all these into the lessons that the young people are getting. And we have an army. And once again, I mean, Dick Gregory, that being the only thing that I remember him saying the most, I think is the most important part. Like, I find myself advocating for young people, even amongst themselves. Like, I have 16-year-old young ladies who told me one time, we're not the same breed as the people who did the sit-ins. And I had to tell her, I looked her straight in her face. I'm like, literally, scientifically, you are the same people.
Right.
You're the same breed. You come from the exact same stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like, no one, maybe no one has asked you to. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I remember when 9/11 happened, they asked us to keep shopping. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Now that people are protesting,
don't let the terrorists
win. You know what I'm saying? Or they're asking us to boycott the NFL, which, you know what I'm saying? I'm okay with that, but like that's not a rebellion. You know what I'm saying?
Right, these kids
are ready to rebel. If someone explained to them what the Confederate flag and the Confederate statues and who Dylann Roof is and what's going on and why they're trying to bring back the imagery of when we were chattel slaves, and they're ready to fight about it, and they need adults to give them something to do other than tell them, you know what I'm saying, go back to class.
There's nothing more revolutionary in America than revolution until it's actually happening. I mean, you know, this is a country where everything you were, I mean, I'm from Charlottesville, again, home of Thomas Jefferson. Every 7 years, the tree of liberty should be enriched by the blood of patriots and tyrants. I mean, you know, that's his quote. The quote of the state of Virginia, Sic Semper Tyrannis, death to tyrants. And the logo of the state is a peasant standing over a king whose crown has fallen with a spear in his hand. A country founded on revolution in every possible way.
Right.
Solidified by, you know, obviously the counter-revolution of the Confederacy, but the intervention of 150,000 African-American soldiers in the Civil War to tip the balance of power there and win. And it's all good historically, and it's all good to learn those lessons, but then they say it's not all good when people much more justified than the colonists. Much more justified. You can make a strong case, as many British historians do, that really— they had very little to complain about.
And just the taxes.
And the taxes, quite frankly. And it's worth looking at the first meeting that Benjamin Franklin had to try to bring together the colonies, because the big issue with the taxes was, oh, well, we need to be defended against Native Americans. And Benjamin Franklin's argument to some of these colonists was like, oh, no, we can form our own army at this stage because we have enough men and enough money that we can, like, destroy Native Americans on our own. We don't need the British. And they're like, so we don't need them at all. Like, we can kill the natives, we can take over the continent, and we can trade with everyone, not just Britain, and we can all get super rich off this joint if we just link up all of the rich people in the 13 colony.
And can I just say this, like, please, like when you continue to have these conversations about how our history is told and how it's represented, because one of the things they're saying about the Confederate monuments is that they're history. But I mean, tell me, I might be wrong, but do they take high school kids by the monument in Charlottesville and explain the history of it while looking at it and discussing it?
Not even
And
close.
Saying, even though there's a big statue 10 feet over your head of this guy on a horse, what he did was wrong? Do they do that? Like, no, they don't. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're completely missing the opportunity to make this a historical conversation about what's going on there. It's just romanticizing the past. And what we need to be doing is having a conversation about how this is an ongoing fight. And the fact that these statues exist is just evidence. That's why I was okay with them. Like, as long as we're having the conversation, I can give you a million reasons why the statues can come down.
Mm-hmm.
But I was okay with them staying because I don't like lying to myself.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if enough of the population exists where those statues are, I want to be reminded, like, this isn't home. You know what I'm saying? So I want us to get to the root of this. I'm against smoke fighting. I want a fire fight. Mm-hmm. So let's get to the whole reason why these things exist.
Well, the root of it, to me, is if you start tearing down the statues of George Washington. I mean,
that's
what it really comes down to some ways, Rachel, I think, is that, you know, and I think that's why people are so angry that these statues are coming down, is I think that there is an unwillingness in America. Forget the Confederate statues. I think you could get all those down. But I think people are really afraid what will happen in this country if there's a true reckoning with the slavery and the genocide that built it up. But I'm curious your thoughts on that, Rich.
I mean, I think it's kind of crazy, too. It just goes into the whole way that people just, like, really worship the Constitution in America. I mean, it's really wild to me, especially when you look at, like, Venezuela, you look at other countries that are in the process of saying that we want to, you know, write our Constitution by the people, for the people, truly. I mean, it's not like the people who wrote the Constitution are old, dead, white men who own slaves. And it's wild, you know, this kind of lifting up of, like, George Washington and, you know, Jefferson, and all these people who are coming out, you know, all these people who, you know, fundamentally, right, or slave owners, fundamentally are backwards. And we teach this to our kids in our textbooks. This is what they learn. And it's just wild to me because it's so obvious that, like, this needs to change. This needs to be updated in no way, shape, or form. Does anything that the Constitution says or any of these kind of old, you know, dead white guys represent anything that's going on the ground here? I mean, it's why we need, it's like, you know, the People's Congress, we've written a manifesto. It's why we've done that, because, you know what, there's a time, and that time is now, to really say that we need to rewrite this. This society is ours, you know? And to go back to the point about young people, actually, I have a lot of volunteers that come into the Justice Center here in New York City. And these folks, they come out. These young kids, they come out and they petition. We've been fighting against rezoning and gentrification here in East Harlem. And they're fighting, you know. And I think a lot of times, like to go to the point earlier, just about how the media is, I think more often than not, you know, when the media is actually pushing something positive for people to have action and change, it's because the power of the people that took that moment, like what you were saying, Eugene. And I think it's more of a myth or a narrative that anyone in general is apathetic. Most people I talk to are actually not apathetic. They actually care deeply a lot about what's going on. Folks on the corner, folks out on the streets, they care a lot. They want to come out. They want to protest. They want to get involved. But a lot of people don't know how. They don't know how to plug in. They don't know how to be involved. That's why organization and organizing is so deeply necessary. If you're not out in the streets talking to people, if we're not out there trying to involve our communities, you know, people won't know where to go, how to fight, how to struggle, or even how to win. You know, what are we fighting for? We're so taught to be so pessimistic. Like all the media, you know, this system uses this negativity that, oh, you know what, you can't accomplish anything, you can't do anything, it's not fruitful to organize it. You know, one, a protest, whatever, you know, we rethink pieces every single day that tell people not to come out. Tina Fey telling people not to come out, when the reality is that, you know, that's working for the system.
Yeah, Tina Fey.
Was she being sarcastic?
I mean, I don't know if she was being sarcastic. Some people think she was. I think that, though, there's been that meme for so long, which is like, just ignore these people because the attention is oxygen for them. But what I always say to people is you got to actually look at how these people recruit on the internet. And a lot of it is wrapped up in going to these places that are considered like black or liberal or whatever and successfully holding an event, which they, you know, interpret to make them strong. But Monty, 20 seconds, but I see you want to make a point.
Yeah, well, I mean... So,
sorry, I know.
No, it's all good. It's all good. There's so many things that can be said here. So, I mean, one of the things that happens is, and to Rachel's point, like the problem with the history is, and the reason that we feel like we have to start over and over again every time there's an uprising around these issues is that we have this myth of a peaceful America. And so we're able to tell young people, oh my God, look what y'all did to the country. Back in the day, there was this peaceful time. And right. Young people need to start looking at everyone, every single generation. I'm tired of hearing 39-year-olds telling 16-year-olds about how bad they are. Because I remember what it was like in 1994. It was, you know what I'm saying? It was violence. It was drug-filled. You know what I'm saying? It was a whole bunch of things going on. So us being able to not tell the history, an honest history, is able to us unload all the problems of the world on the next generation without any kind of context.
Well, that's a fantastic point. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you to both of us. That is our show on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.